Hey everybody, it is Wednesday and it's a big Wednesday because we're doing this a little bit early to kind of to make it a little easier on me because I am now East Coast and I'm working and going to hockey games and doing events and my buddy Peelzy, who is always ready to go. But it's Snipes and Stripes right here on nofilter.net, another Wednesday, and we got a great guest, Theo Fleury, that is going to be coming on and joining us. I'll tell you, one of the most fiercest competitors of all time. And I can't wait to chat with him because him and I have so much in common. Peelzy, how you doing, buddy?
I'm awesome, bud. You're in Toronto. You're going to the Leaf game tonight with one of my idols growing up in Wendell Clark.
Talk
about tough, man. They didn't come any tougher than Clark, did they?
No. For a guy that can score goals, a guy that can hit, a guy that can fight, you see some of his tapes, some of his the things that he's done over the years. He was just a beast. He was one of those guys. And I had an early connection with him because I used to play really hard too, right? I used to hit like crazy and I was small. And people used to say, you better be careful hitting as much as you do, because Wendell at one point, his back gave out. And he had a bad back, and it really, because of his physical play, he's lost a lot of time due to his back. They're like, you're going to turn into Wendell Clark and get a bad back. And I'm like, all right, I guess. I didn't listen to anybody and just kept going at my business. But
some of those classic fights when he's fighting Rick Tocchet, when Rick Tocchet was throwing him back then, man, oh man, like Wendell Clark. There's not a Toronto Maple Leaf fan in the world that did not love Wendell Clark.
Well, it's always the conversation here, right? Who are the most popular Toronto Maple Leafs of all time? Dougie Gilmore, Salming, Wendell Clark, Ty Domi. It's always kind of circles around those guys. But Ty always seems to get his head stuck in there somewhere. That big old Teflon head of his.
Of course he gets his head stuck in there. It's as big as a garbage truck.
The best. But anyway, thanks to whiskeyinthewild.com, my chocolate whiskey. Feel free to go out and buy the best whiskey in the world. To Bet Online, we love our connection with Bet Online, that your place to win money. And my boy Tim Peel's protected neck guards, trying to make sure we protect all the kids in the world. And I hope everything is going well with that, PLZ. That is a fantastic organization that you started with, protected neck guards.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. So listen, we're just gonna jump right into it because we could talk for hours with this guy.
Yeah, we could.
Can't wait to talk to Theo. It's been a long time since I've seen him. And I can't wait to see what he's up to. But God, I don't even know where to start with Theo. There he is. There he is, my boy. What's up, Theo?
What's up, boys?
I'm loving the hat, Theo. It looks good on you, brother.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great, great day. Actually, it was a great week here that week. Donald Trump just saving America, buddy. We will get to the political aspect of our lives. But, buddy, thank you for coming on. It's really, for Tim and I, it's a pleasure. I don't think I have to tell you how much I admire you and our friendship over many, many years. And I appreciate you taking the time, my friend.
A couple of old warriors having a chat.
You know what, Theo, it's like JR said, it's a thrill for me too. As a kid that grew up in a trailer park in New Brunswick, I'm 2 years older than you at 58. And you were one of those guys. I was a small kid growing up. Well, not that I'm a giant now, I'm 5'10", but I just, you know, the way you played, and let's get right into it. I was trying to look up today, who was the GM that drafted you in Calgary?
So it was Cliff Fletcher, More importantly, there was a guy named Ian McKenzie, and
was he the scout?
He was the head scout of the Flames, and there was a really great bar in Moose Jaw where I played, and so Ian loved to come to the bar in Moose Jaw, and so while he was there, he'd come and watch us play, and basically every time he'd write something about me, about the game he watched, he said, Fleury was the best player on the ice. Fleury was the best player on the ice. Fleury was the best, over and over again. And so, you know, I was picked like 470th in the draft because The first year of eligibility, I didn't get drafted. Okay. Gotcha. So there was 12 rounds, 230 some guys.
I see you're thinking.
And then the next year I got picked 166th overall in the eighth round by the Calgary Flames. And I don't know if you remember a guy named Al McNeil.
Absolutely.
Okay. He's a Maritimer.
Yep.
And he was the assistant GM. And when they drafted me, he threw his pen across the table and said, "We drafted another fucking jockey," he said. Right?
Al was a good man, too.
And, you know, I always look at the draft as it doesn't matter what number you get picked at. You know, it's basically an opportunity. That's all it was, you know. And, you know, I went to my first training camp. I finished first in the fitness testing. I actually got into three exhibition games. And so everybody in the organization who didn't believe that I could play, by the end of training camp, they all agreed that I would play someday in the NHL. And so, you know, but yeah, it was amazing. And you know, I couldn't have gone to a better organization. I couldn't have been part of a better team, you know, to play on that team as a rookie and be mentored by, you know, all of those Hall of Famers, you know, was pretty incredible. And the thing was, is, you know, I had almost 500 points in junior. And when I got to Calgary in 1989, they didn't even care if I scored a goal, right? My job on that team was to be the fourth line centerman. And my job was to draw penalties, change momentum of games, and provide a spark for the team. And so my role was simple, you know, it wasn't complicated. It was easy because we had such a great team, you know. Like I always tell people, I was a fourth line centerman on the Calgary Flames. And they're like, fourth line centerman. They're like, who did you play behind? Neuendijk, Otto, and Gilmore.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, but Theo, it's amazing to me because obviously it was a different game back then.
Yeah.
And back then, guys that are on the smaller side don't survive.
Right.
And no. You came in and you were just a freak of the nature type player. But tell me what it was like. I mean, obviously going through Moose Jaw and the size, did you ever think about your size? Did you ever think about, can I make it at my size? Was because you know that the league probably had to have thought that because that was their mentality.
Right. Back
then. I was small, but what was it like back then? I know you have the willpower inside, but what was it like for you on the outskirts coming into Moose Jaw, missing a year? Like, tell me your mentality and, you know, what was it? It was just amazing story, man.
Well, like when I look in the mirror, I don't see somebody who's small. You know what I mean? Like I see somebody who's, you know, like I was ultra talented, ultra gifted, talented, right?
Yes, you were.
So that right there sets me apart from most little guys that tried to play the game. And then, you know, in junior, you know, like back in the day, so all of the tough guys that became the heavyweights in the NHL played in the Western Hockey League. My first year in Moose Jaw, I was 5'3", 125 pounds soaking wet. Okay?
Shut up.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
And so I was playing against the Berubis, the Grim Reapers, the Baumgartners, the Mansons. Like they were all playing. That year I played in the Western Hockey League. And so I was fortunate enough, I played on a line with Mike Keane and Kelly Buckberger.
Wow.
So two of the, you know, the toughest guys, you know, around. And so they made it very easy for me to, you know, maneuver around and sort of get my bearings underneath me, you know. Like I remember we went up to Prince Albert one night and like they had the toughest team in hockey. Okay. They had a whole line of guys.
Was Medano there yet? Was Medano there yet?
No, this is Danny Hodgson.
Okay, right before he got there.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So they had a line of Bennett, Fraser, and Dean Bram All three guys had 300 penalty minutes.
Yeah, Kurt Frazier was tough.
And so I'm standing on the blue line, the anthem's playing, and I look over across, and there's Baumgartner and Manson, our defense partners, and they're foaming at the mouth. And I remember the first shift, Dave Manson hit me so hard, I thought I broke every bone in my body. And I said to myself, I go, that can never happen again.
Yeah.
And so I became very good with my stick. So if you were going to come and hit me, you're either coming through my stick or you're getting an elbow or a slew foot or something. And so, you know, that became the great equalizer. And, you know, I realized early on in my career that 90% of the guys that I was playing against were bluffers.
Right.
Right. And so I used that psychologically because I was willing to die in order to win. And I played, you know, I competed at the highest level.
Yeah, right? You did.
Every shift was like my last shift in the NHL. And I knew that the guys that I was playing against, they weren't willing to die in order to do that. So right away, I knew that I could take that guy anywhere on the ice and do whatever I wanted to him because he wasn't going to do it.
Yeah, where'd that come from though, Theo? Where'd that come from?
Like, well, it's just survival, right? Like I survived as a kid, you know, like I grew up in this home where both my parents were not available because they had their own demons that they were dealing with. And, you know, they were addicted. And so basically from the time I was 5 years old until now, I've made every major decision in my life on my own. And so wow. when you're living in that kind of environment, you learn how to survive. And you learn how to navigate, you know, your way through life in order to be successful.
You know, Theo, why do you think it was like, JR, you played in the Quebec League. You know, the Ontario League was known as a soft league compared to the WHL. We can go through the list of players like Kaminsky and Chase and Twist and the guys you mentioned. Why was the Western League, why was it... It was a battle out there every night, wasn't it? Like it was crazy.
It was crazy. Like every night there was either a bench clearing brawl or a line brawl or something, you know.
You had the Clark boys.
You know, a lot of us guys that play in the Western League, we come from small towns. So,
right.
You know, we're in friggin' bar fights and like playground fights every single day of our lives. You know what I mean? So, and it was kind of like the survival of the fittest. But, you know, you think about, and I was going to mention, you know, the guys that competed at the same level that I did, like, I love that because it made me a better player.
Right.
You know, when I was playing against JR, I knew it was going to be physical. I knew it was going to be hard. And I was going to have to play my very best. And I'm going to have to dig as deep as possible to find, you know, that edge in order to win, you know, playing against, you know, the Battle of Alberta. I played every single shift against Bukaboom and Smith.
Yeah.
We're D partners. I played every shift. I'd go to Chicago, Chelios, every single shift I had to play against those guys. You know what I mean? So go to Jersey, Scott Stevens, every friggin' shift. So, you know, you either learn or you fail or they bury you, right? Like that's the kind of league it was. There was no, you know, nobody went easy on you. So I didn't want them to. I didn't want anybody to go easy on me.
Right? So the NHL gets a new franchise this year in Salt Lake City. You growing up in Canada and the background you have, you probably didn't go to Park City too many times to go skiing on vacation, much like I didn't.
Oh, 100%. We went to practice with our ski shit on.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. And I remember we had 8 days off at Christmas, and we would go to the rink for practice in our ski shit, practice, and then head up to the mountain and ski all day. It was awesome.
You loved it there, though, right? You loved playing there.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best cities in America, you know?
We had
an incredible team there. Incredible coaches and the fans were unbelievable. Like to play in the Salt Palace. Like, we put 13,000 people in that building every night. And it was, you know, it was like playing in the NHL. You know, right. It was like, you know, it was probably more successful than the Hartford Whalers at the time, you know.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
who coached that team, Theo?
Paul Baxter and Bobby Francis.
Yeah. Baxy. Well, Baxy's famous line. Hey, you played great tonight. How'd I play?
Yeah.
Well, you're
paramount that we be recognizant of the guy coming down the back door. That's Paul Baxter.
Well, your old trainer, I think you lived with him your first year there, Brian Patafi. Brian Patafi sent, we're friends, and because he was in the minors, he was in St. John, New Brunswick when I was coming up. And Taff sent me a message yesterday, and he said, make sure you tell Theo I said hello. So,
yeah, he's one of my favorite all-time guys in hockey, that fella. The greatest character you'll ever want to meet.
Well, he's a
stand-up
comedian.
Yeah. It's hilarious. It's awesome.
Hey, what was it like? What was it like coming in that first year for you? Obviously, you said you're a fourth line behind those guys. I remember, you know, that was my first year too, coming in, and we played you in the conference finals, and it was a war. It was a battle. I mean, that was, you know, Lanny's last year, and I can remember just the how hard it was to play in the playoffs, and at that time, physical, but like. I remember the jousting, the verbal joust you and I used to have. Like, it was epic. It was two young guys going at each other. But
did you guys go at it?
Oh, we yapped and we slashed and we had such a respect for each other. But we went after each other, especially verbally, because we seemed to meet each other in some big moments and big games, especially in our first year.
Yeah.
What was it like then that first year with that team and getting to win a Stanley Cup so early in your career?
Well, it was, like I said, you know, to be a rookie and to be mentored by a group of guys like that, you know, to be taught how to be a professional and how to prepare yourself. And, you know, and it was, you know, we were so good. Like, that team was so good.
Jesus,
like, we could beat you anyway.
Yep.
Offensive game, you know, we could win 8-7, you know, and we could win 1-0. And if you wanted to scrap, we could do that. Ugh. You know, it was crazy.
She had monster after monster after monster. And then they had you just chopping people in the ankles, hitting everything in sight, flying by, scoring big goals. Who was the one guy on that team that kind of, that like really made a difference in you?
Well, Timmy Hunter was my line mate.
Wow.
And
he's the best. I love Hunts.
He was such a great guy. I'll never forget. We're sitting on the bench, my first game against the Quebec Nordiques in Calgary, January 3rd, 1989. And he leans over to me, he says, "Okay, kid, you know you can do whatever you want out on the ice." And I'm like, "Are you sure?" And that year, he had the most penalty minutes in his career because he was fucking looking after me. But, that team was just amazing. And you know what? What happened was in the first game of the first series against Vancouver, Mel Bridgman broke Gary Suter's jaw.
Oof.
Okay? And so I played the point on the power play for the rest of the playoffs. So that's where I was getting the most of my ice time, was on the power play. And I was playing the left side. So I was on my wrong hand, and for them to have the confidence enough to put me on the point on the power play as a rookie, you know, playing with Al MacInnis, like, just get him the puck. Yeah.
Theo, you know, I'm looking at the guys that were on that team, and as JR alluded to, that team was loaded. How come that team wasn't able to repeat?
Because we lost all our leadership the following year. Lanny left, Poplinski retired, Lou went back to Sweden. So we lost a big part of our leadership group, and we just couldn't find just couldn't get it back.
And then a couple of years later, they trade Dougie to Toronto in the big trade, right?
Yeah. Well, there was a bunch of things that were going on, you know, that we just couldn't find that same chemistry that we had with that group of guys, you know, and because we probably should have won one more Stanley Cup, I'm thinking, because we had such a great team. And, you know, unfortunately, we ended up losing to Gretzky and the Kings in the first round that following year. So that was probably our best chance to win another Stanley Cup was that year. So, yeah, but unfortunately, we didn't. But as JR knows, that thing is hard to win.
Right.
You know? It was impossible.
I played another 14 years after that, and the closest I got was when I got traded to Colorado, and we lost to Dallas in Game 7 of the conference finals, and Dallas went on to win their one and only Stanley Cup. So if we would have won that Game 7, I would have two Stanley Cups. But, you know, like I said, that thing is hard to win, and it's even harder now because there's – 32 teams. When we were playing, there was only 21.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, out of those 21, there were five or six teams that sucked that you knew you were going to get 4 or 5 points.
Point night.
This is where we're padding our stats. Boys. Yeah. Let's get ready. Right.
Absolutely.
Is that what you guys would call a point night?
Oh, yeah. Ottawa, San Jose, guaranteed five or six at least.
Exactly. Especially if you scored in the first couple of shifts. You got a point in the first couple of shifts. You're all like, right. Here we go.
Here we go. Feeling good.
Right?
Give me the puck. Yeah.
Theo, do you go to many Flames games anymore?
No.
Before I ask you something, you guys were talking about, Theo, about size and JR, how guys weren't drafted back then. It was the same way. And Theo, you know, Mike Civic, the linesman that lives in Calgary.
Yeah.
You know, Civvy was 6'7", 6'8". I remember when I got hired in 98 and well before 98, they weren't hiring linesmen, let alone players. They weren't hiring linesmen unless you were 6 foot or bigger, because you had to get in and break up 5-6 fights every night. So it was the same thing for, it was the same thing for referees and linesmen as it was for players. But yeah. So what do you think now? Like they, you know, I'll turn on a game on a Saturday night and they say the Battle of Alberta and it's like, there's five,
totally checks, different.
There's five checks thrown in the entire game.
Yeah. I call it the pillow fight.
Yeah.
It is. It seems like every night's a pillow fight, no matter where you are in the game right now.
I'll never forget the series in 91 that we played Edmonton. That was an absolute, like, it was violent. It was brutal. Like, we were full baseball swinging, slashing each other, no penalties. And you go in front of the net on the power play, and they were breaking those double fiberglass cohos over your back. Toothpicks flying all over the place, no penalties. It was unbelievably brutal that whole entire series.
Was that the sliding OT win?
Yeah, that year. Yeah,
that was game six. I can picture that.
Oh, it's iconic.
It is an iconic game-winning celebration that will last forever.
When we play as long as we play, we usually have one iconic moment, you know, in our careers, you know, and that was it for me, you know. So, you know, and to score it in Edmonton against, you know, our greatest rival to get to Game 7, you know. And here's the thing. I was playing with a second degree separation of my MCL and a second degree separation of my shoulder, and they were shooting me up with Novocaine, you know, the whole entire series, right?
Wow.
But that's what we did.
That's what we did, right?
Long ways from the heart, you know?
Needles, man. Needles every game in the playoffs. Every game.
They tape an aspirin to your forehead and say, get out there.
That's for sure. It was unbelievable.
Crazy.
Hey, off... Off topic, Theo, you're out in Western Canada. What have you been hearing about what's going on with JT Miller out in Vancouver? Have you been hearing anything about that?
Well,
something's going on.
I have a philosophy. So, you know, this generation of kids is probably like the Connor McDavids and forward are one sport athletes.
Yeah. Okay.
They've only played hockey their whole entire lives. And so they've worked extremely hard to get to that level. And then they get there and they're burnt out because they've done nothing else but play hockey their whole entire lives. And so mentally, I know the mental side of the game. Like there's some nights where you just go, I don't have it.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have it. Right. And you know, if you're one of the better players on the team and the team's not doing well, then you put even more pressure on yourself because, you know, that's why you did what you did to get to where you got to, is you want to be, you know, at the top of the league and the top of the game. And so, you know, I can see how mentally that affects, and let's face it, these guys aren't as tough mentally as we were, you know. You know, we drank, right?
We played poker.
Yeah.
Yeah. They drink health shakes and play video games.
Yeah. There's such an onus on, you know, mental health these days that I can see totally where the guy's like, yeah, I need a break. Like I can't manage what's going on. And so I need a break. I need to get away because it's intense, you know, like the coaches nowadays, like it's intense.
Like it's big business now. I mean, it's literally huge. billion business. Huge. You know, I'm sitting here in the Ritz-Carlton in Toronto and literally I'm the Nashville Predators are staying here. And I see the coaches I go down for a coffee at 7:30 this morning, 7 o'clock. And the coaches are going into the conference room to start looking at tape and go through meetings.
For what though, JR? For what? What are they looking for?
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying. Like, what are they looking for?
That they don't already know.
Yeah.
It is so branded now to data and computers and, you know, information.
Micromanaged.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, which bothers me to no end, they have these iPads on the benches. I mean, go screw yourself. If somebody put an iPad in front of me,
I would fucking smash that thing into a million pieces.
I would like to know how many iPads they go through, because if it was back in our day,
they would be
broken. The new ones every game.
Well, no, I mean, if you're a smart hockey player, you know when you've made a mistake on the ice, and you don't need to be shown the same mistake 50 different ways. But guess what? I'm the only guy on this whole entire bench who can actually make up for the mistake that I just made.
Yeah, like I want to see where I made the mistake. No, you know, if you have hockey sense, you know exactly where you made the mistake. You know what it was in the play, where the people were, and you go back to the bench and you go, fuck!
I know. Right?
And nowadays, like, give me the iPad. I want to see what happened. No. What a bunch of horse shit.
Yeah.
It really does take away from the actual grit and capacity for your brain to dig deep, really deep. Right. Yeah. Cause these kids make a lot of money, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Everybody should make their money. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I just think with a lot of money, with all this technology, you see, you go into the arena, they have their own chefs, they have their own, they make four meals a day. It's cushy.
Yeah.
Right? Where do they feel uncomfortable? We felt uncomfortable. Did you feel uncomfortable when you got to the league?
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah. Because we had competition within the team, right? There was guys every bit as good as me sitting out, right? in order for me to play on the 1989 Stanley Cup team, Lanny McDonald was sitting out.
Right.
And I was playing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
So you're out in the ice, you know, skating around on eggshells. Like, I don't want to make any mistakes. You know what I mean? But thank God, you know, Terry Crisp allowed me to make some mistakes early on, you know, in that year, because he knew when push came to shove, as the games got harder and the competition got stiffer, he knew that I was going to be able to show up. I wasn't going to fold under the pressure. You know what I mean? So, yeah, the game is way overcoached.
Yeah, way overcoached.
You know,
it's too much info.
There's no need to have four guys on the bench who are coaches. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I remember watching a game, an old game of Montreal Canadiens. And it was Montreal Canadiens, and they were in the Stanley Cup Finals, and Scotty Bowman was running the whole entire bench. So you want to change the game, you're only allowed to have one coach on the bench.
Right.
During the game. What do you think of that, JR?
I think you take more info, take more noise away from these kids. Take the noise away. The noise only, it's clutter.
Yeah, right? And I love how they say the game is more skilled. No, it's not, because they don't allow the skilled kids to do what they do best, right?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
And then, loses their minds when they see McDavid and Bedard and, you know, Austin Matthews. I'm like, we had 40 of those guys playing in the league when I was playing.
Well, we played in the best generation.
Oh, there's no question.
You know why they say it's more skilled guys? It's because you don't have the hooking and the holding now. And because the game is faster, people automatically
think that
it's more skilled.
Well, what Theo said earlier is these kids, that's all they've done since they're 5 or 6 years old. And they've practiced and they ate and they trained to do this. So everybody can skate. Yeah. You know, we had fourth liners back in the early 90s that could skate, but they
You got to push them on the ice. You just have to push them on the ice.
We had goaltenders that couldn't do the splits. So they would do the one-legged pushes or just, you know, Grant Fuhr and Millen.
Because if they went down, they ain't getting back up.
They ain't getting back up. That's right. You know, and that, so everybody today can skate like the wind.
Yeah.
Everybody can shoot the puck like a rocket ship. But there's very few that have the toolbox, you know, the tools to put in the toolbox, right? Yeah. So it's just amazing. So you leave Calgary. You go off to Colorado Rangers. You had an unbelievable, obviously, 18-year career. What was it like playing for Colorado and the Rangers? Like, did you have as much fun? Like, what was it like when you went to those places?
Well, when I went to Colorado and walked in the dressing room, I thought I was at the All-Star game.
Right.
Seriously, that was like, that team was like, the 89 team was good. That team was better. Top to bottom.
Wow.
Like, it was scary. And I remember, you know Claude Lemieux, right?
Yeah, very, very well.
One of my favorite guys of all time.
Okay? I'm still very, very close with Pep. Very close. Yeah.
So anyways, I walk in the dressing room and he's the first guy I see there. And I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, what do you mean? I go, it's February. I go, you don't show up till like March, April. I go,
Mr. Conn Smythe.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Who was on that team, Theo?
Oh, shit.
Who wasn't on that team?
Really?
Forsberg, Sakic.
Kamensky.
Hayduke.
Kamensky.
Chris Drury. Dale Hunter.
Adam
Patrick Foote. Waugh. Claude Lemieux.
Footy.
Footy, yeah.
Yeah.
Holy hell.
Ozilinch. Yeah, it was
dumb.
We practiced as a team. I was there for 5 months. As a team, we practiced 6 times together. Everything really? was optional. If it was nice outside, we'd go to the practice rink, and Patrick Waugh, he loved to golf, and I loved to golf. So if it was nice out, he'd go right into Bob Hartley's office and say, "We ain't practicing today." And he'd come by my stall and he'd say, "I'll meet you at Castle Pines at 1 o'clock." I'm like, "I'll be there."
That's fantastic.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. A bomb squad.
It was awesome. You know,
people don't understand how like good Peter Forsberg was, how good Valerie Kaminsky was. I mean, these, unfortunately, you know, obviously Sakic was just, you know, I was with Joe last week and he's just so unassuming.
I know.
But holy hell, when he got a chance to shoot that, oh my gosh. What was it like?
I'll never forget. So my first game in Colorado was against Edmonton and we were actually down in the game. So they put me, Sakic, and Forsberg on a line, okay? And we had the puck for a full 2 minutes. Edmonton didn't touch the puck for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And at the end of the shift, Sandis Ozolins passed the puck to me, and I literally could have taken the puck, put it over the goal line, pulled it back out, put my glove, and threw it to the referee. That's how wide open I was at the end of this 2 minutes.
No way. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Just the absolute clinic.
It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Theo, you were a yapper on the ice. You loved
No.
You loved stirring the shit and so on. But I never thought of you being, after your playing career, being a public speaker. And JR, I want to read a line from one of the speeches that I saw Theo do recently. He goes, quote, "Trauma is the string that binds us all together." And I love that quote. I love that quote. I think it's so applicable to a lot of us in the lives that we've had. Like I've watched a bunch of your speeches on YouTube and so on. How are you so comfortable at this? Like, it's like, I don't know if you're uncomfortable at all up there speaking about your life and everything. How did that happen?
Well, geez. So basically, you know, I was hiding a secret for 27 years. Right. And, you know, that secret almost took my life, right? And so when I wrote the book in 2009, you know, I was newly sober. And I kind of knew that if I kept drinking and kept going down the road that I was gonna go down, I was gonna die, right? And not a quick death. I was gonna die the slow addict, alcoholic death, you know, lonely, bitter, angry, resentful, you know, all these things. And I knew that I was way better than that, but I hadn't told anybody about this secret that I was carrying around. And, you know, we have this saying in 12 step, you're only as sick as your secrets. Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was sick. I was sick physically, emotionally, and spiritually because I was holding on to this secret. So 2009, I write this book and, you know, I tell the whole entire story from start to finish. And, you know, when I left the game, all I had was a grade 12 diploma from Vanier Collegiate in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. I had more than half my life left to live and had no idea what the rest of my life was going to look like. Right. And I didn't have a whole lot of expectations. I didn't think the book was going to be as popular as it turned out to be. And so I show up at the first book signing in Toronto and I sit down at the book table and I start signing books and out of the corner of my eye, I spot a guy in line and he's got my book clutched against his chest and his face is buried in the floor and his sweatpants are dirty, his t-shirt's ripped and his hair's greasy. And I'm like, wonder what's up with this guy. Right. So I follow him all the way in the line. He gets to the front of the line, puts the book on the table, looks me in the eye and says, "Me too."
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got chills.
Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew what the rest of my life was going to look like, because I said, By me finding the courage and the strength to tell my story, I can inspire and help other people do the exact same thing. Well, you know what happened after that first book signing? I got completely run over by people. Everywhere I went, 5, 10, 15, 20 people were coming up at every book signing, every speaking engagement, every workshop I was doing. They were coming up and saying, hey, I read your book. You told my story. Me too. Hey, I saw your documentary. You told my story. Hey, I read an article in a newspaper. You told my story. Me too. And so, you know.
That had to be so liberating, man.
Oh, it was unbelievable because I didn't, like, I was so scared before the book came out. I was, like, literally shitting in my pants because I had no idea how everybody was going to react to what was in this book. And sure enough, you know, I found the absolute true purpose for my life, you know, and then everything made sense, right? My parents made sense. My sexual abuse made sense. My drinking, my mental illness, everything made sense.
Yeah.
It made sense. And I haven't stopped, you know, like I've done 900 speeches since 2009, you know, and traveled all over North America, sharing this story of trauma, mental health and addiction. And here's what I've, so basically I've been studying human behavior for 20 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what I've discovered is, you know, we have a mental health crisis on the planet and we have an addiction crisis on the planet. Okay.
Yep.
But what we fail to do is we fail to acknowledge that it's the trauma, the unresolved trauma that brings us into the mental health space. Because what is mental illness? Mental illness is emotional pain and suffering.
Yes.
Okay. And what is emotional pain and suffering? Mental illness. So now we're left with this silent suffering that nobody can see. So how do we deal with it? Well, we gravitate towards the dark side of life and get involved in addictive behavior as a coping mechanism to
drown it out.
Emotional pain and suffering, right?
No.
So drugs, alcohol, food, sex, gambling, work, you name it, right? Whatever distracts us from what we're feeling. And it wasn't until I addressed my spiritual, emotional, and physical trauma. And the biggest piece, and I say this, it wasn't until I grasped onto the concept of spirituality that my life changed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I had to hit my knees and I had to surrender to a God of my own understanding, not a religious God, just the God of my understanding. And I surrendered and said, okay, left to my own defenses, me left to running my own life is the biggest shit show on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to turn that over to you, God, and you drive the bus. And I'm not going to question anything from here on now, as long as you keep me from those coping mechanisms. Right. And he took that away. He took away the obsession to drink and do drugs and seek out, you know, these coping mechanisms.
Wow.
And then I was really able to do the healing that I needed to do, right? So that I can have, you know, because what's the goal? Peace, joy, happiness, and serenity. That's the goal of any healing journey. And, you know, when I was growing up and playing hockey, I couldn't do that. Like I couldn't face those demons. But after I retired and I had, you know, all this time and all this opportunity, you know, and they say, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears.
Right.
Right. And as soon as I surrendered, those teachers started showing up, right? Every person that I needed, to help me make sense of all of this, they started showing up. And, you know, me being a guy that that was willing to do whatever it took to feel better, like I just lapped all of this stuff up, you know, and I Velcroed myself to these people because they were talking my language and they were speaking my language. And so now, after being on a 20-year, you know, spiritual awakening and spiritual journey, now I'm one of the I'm one of those teachers, you know,
who sure are
to, right, to help
you. You sure are.
Well, right? I know you didn't. I know you didn't get it. You didn't write this book to be an inspiration to people. That wasn't your focus when you're writing that book. But what has happened through writing that book is you have become an inspiration to people. Yeah. But I do want to ask you, because I think I saw in one of your speeches, you said that basically for 27 years, you didn't really sleep. And the only time you slept is if it was, you know, alcohol and drugs. Where were you when you contemplated taking your life and you put the gun in your mouth?
Yeah. Well, so basically after we won the Olympics in Salt Lake City, I should have retired. Because after that, I just, like, the thing that made me a great hockey player, like that competitiveness, that drive, all, like, it was gone. Like, I was just like, okay, like, I've accomplished everything I can possibly accomplish in the game, and I just don't want to be here anymore. You know what I mean? And I was struggling mentally, like, bad. Like, I was having panic attacks before games. I was like, I was a mess. And so and everybody thinks this was my addiction that took me out of the game. No, it was the unmanageability of my mental illness. I could no longer, like, I could barely function as a human being. And so, I went through the whole NHL substance abuse program. I was in stage four. They kicked me out of the NHL because I couldn't stop drinking, couldn't stop doing drugs, and, you know, my behavior was out of control. And so I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in a 6,000 square foot house on two Jack Nicklaus golf courses all by myself. Every single person that loved and cared about me was gone out of my life because they were sick of putting up with my bullshit. So I'd been up for, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 days, hadn't had any sleep at all. I just, this thought came in my head. I was like, I don't want to be here anymore. Right. So I jump in my truck. I go down to the local pawn shop in Santa Fe and walk through the door. And there's a guy standing behind the counter, and I had like a wad of cash. So I slammed it on the table and I said, I need a gun and some bullets. 45 seconds later, I'm back in my car with the gun, and the bullets, heading home. And I get home, and I have this awesome home theater room with a big coffee table. So I put the gun and the bullets on the coffee table. I pour out a whole bunch of cocaine a la Scarface. I snort a whole bunch of lines. I grab a bottle of vodka, and I drink about a third of it. And I sit there, and I reflect on my life, right? All the amazing things that happened, all the horrible things that happened, like a movie playing in my head. And so, I don't know, I probably sat there for a good 45 minutes and then finally got up enough courage, grabbed the gun, loaded the gun, put the gun in my mouth. And I remember it rattling against my teeth. And I remember what it tasted like. And still, this movie's playing in my head. And then right at the moment of truth, when it was time to pull the trigger and end my life, this little voice comes into my head and says, you've never quit anything in your life. Why are you quitting now?
Wow.
And that allowed me to take the gun and throw it into the desert. And I had two choices. Was I going to die or was I going to live? Well, I chose to live. But guess what? I have no clue how to live life on life's terms, right? All I know how to do is cope. That's it. Whether I'm happy, sad, mad, glad, all I know, it's a feeling. And I know how to make it go away, right? And that was the start of this incredible 20-year healing journey that I've been on.
Wow. You know?
Yeah.
It's absolutely spectacular. I've kind of gone through a quarter of what you were just talking about in my own journey, in my mm-hmm. my own mental illness and my own addictions. I had to go through that whole aspect too. So I just sitting here, I've got chills just mm-hmm. listening to you and how inspired I am right now. Like I want to go out and, tackle the world seriously. Right. Yeah. Now.
Well,
I'm going to ask you this. I'm going to ask you this. This will be kind of the last kind of moving on question, because you have done everything. You have won a Stanley Cup. You have won major world juniors. You have won Olympic gold. You have done everything. Your stats are insane. I don't know if you ever see the stuff that I say, but I was very fortunate to finally get into the Hall of Fame this year, and I've mm-hmm. been you've been the one person that I have said, you and Alex McGillney, I have no idea why these two gentlemen are not in the Hall of Fame. You want to talk about two people that should be there the most mm-hmm. is you and him. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of that sits in you right now. How much of that do you need that in your life to kind of just close the lid on everything? Because you've done some amazing things, Theo, and mm-hmm. the amount of people that you have helped. Where does that sit with you, buddy?
It fluctuates, like it fluctuates. Like I know from my peers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they all agree. Every time I run into Gretz or Mario or whoever it is, right? Talk, whoever.
It's a million percent.
Right. They all say, you should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame, right? And so in my mind, I'm already there, because the people that matter the most
sure
have said it. You know what I mean? But here's the thing, what happened to me as an adolescent happened in the game of hockey. Okay. Mm-hmm. And because I told my story the way I told it, I've been basically canceled by the NHL. Okay. So who's responsible? Who's responsible? Right. What if I have to be accountable for my actions, which I have been, because I healed yes. myself yes. and now I'm being of service to people. Okay. Yes. So why isn't anybody asking the NHL? Because here's the story. In 1996, Sheldon Kennedy told his story and they could have made changes. In 2009, I told my story and they could have made changes. And what happened in Chicago? It went all the way up to the NHL, where an NHL hockey player was abused by someone in a position of trust and power. So that's my fault. I have to pay for that.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to pay for that. Really?
I think it's the other way around with how it should be. The fact that you were able to do all this with what happened to you makes you even more of a Hall of Famer.
100%.
No, I get it. And I'm so sick of answering this question.
I know. Trust me. Because, I've been because, through it. I because, asked you this because I've been, you and I have been getting the same question
yeah.
for over a decade.
As I see it, the work has already been done. And if you so see fit to bestow this incredible honor on me, I would be ecstatic. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the greatest honor we can receive as athletes.
Yeah.
Is any Hall of Fame, and it's, yeah. and it's, I really, I don't know. I really don't know. I played the game as honest as anybody has ever played the game.
Yep.
Like it didn't matter what kind of shape I was in. If you throw a puck on the ice, I am going to give you everything I have. Yep. And I did. I did for 15 years.
Yep.
You know? And so, like I said, it's out of my hands. And hopefully someday that will happen. Hopefully I'm still alive when it does happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know what? What I'm doing today is so much more important.
Right.
You know, the biggest epidemic on the planet is unresolved trauma. It's not mental illness. It's not addiction. We have a serious unresolved trauma issue on the planet. And who are the biggest perpetrators of abuse on the planet? Government. Government are the biggest perpetrators of abuse on the planet.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
And so, why have I been so outspoken when it comes to politics is because I made a promise to myself in 2009 that if I saw abuse, I was going to call it out. And that's all I've been doing for the last 5 years is calling out systemic government abuse at the very highest levels of government.
You sure have, buddy. And yeah. I will tell you, it is totally evident. What we see, your effect, your passion goes beyond levels that I think anybody can imagine, both in your personal life and your professional life. I got to commend you because you're an inspiration to me, buddy. I love you to death. I know for a fact you will be on that stage one day. I know for a fact you will be alive to see it, and I will too. And I can't wait. I can't wait to be in that, in those chairs, watching you tell your story in front of the hockey world, where you deserve to be, my friend.
Yeah. And
I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Well, I appreciate it. And when you got elected last summer, I was like, oh my God. I was like,
there's a chance.
The Dumb and Dumber. Are you saying there's a chance?
You're saying there's a chance. That's awesome. I knew right where you're going. I knew it.
Yeah.
Well,
but you know what though? I don't even know if I will be able. I don't even think I'll be able to say my speech that night because there's so many people that I need to thank.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and
I know.
And not hockey people. I'm talking about, you know, people who saw me at my lowest point in my whole entire life, who kind of picked me up and dusted me off and, you know, showed me.
Yep.
Showed me a better way to do this thing called life, because I wasn't doing it very good for a long, long time, you know. But, you know, God is great. And, you know, thank God he stepped in and you know, saved my life, saved my ass.
Well, thank God, because you're changing lives. So keep spreading the word, keep spreading the gospel, buddy, and keep being Theo Fleury.
I will.
Appreciate you being on with us.
I'm never going to change, that's for sure.
Theo, we really appreciate you taking the time to join JR and I today. You are an inspiration.
Yeah.
But selfishly growing up watching you, man, you were a stud.
God,
you were a stud. 5'6" and you were a stud. And I've enjoyed this thoroughly. I love how I'm the three of us are a lot alike, where we wear our heart on our sleeves and we really don't give a shit what anybody else thinks, because I don't care. And as you know, JR knows, the only people that matter are your family and your very close friends, and everybody else is just, it's white noise. So,
I know where I was, I know where I've been, and I know where I'm headed now. So
exactly.
It's a good place to be.
Yes, it is, buddy. Yes, it is.
Those three jerseys look good. Behind you too. That's a great picture.
You got time for one more story? Because this is a good one.
Yeah, go ahead.
So do you remember the World Championships in Finland? Remember?
Yeah, I remember. 91.
Okay, so we're playing the Americans in the last game. And we need to win by 4 goals to have a chance to win the gold medal. Okay. So there's like a minute and a half left in the game. We're up by 3 goals. Allan Eagleson comes flying out of the crowd and calls a timeout. And he doesn't go to our bench. He goes directly to the Americans bench. He goes, "We need one more fucking goal." Okay?
I remember this.
So it's me and JR at the faceoff dot. JR doesn't even put his stick on the ice.
I remember
draw
this.
Draw back to Jamie McCowan. He gets the red line, dumps it in. I go full bore into the corner, fully expecting to get fucking smoked.
Yeah.
I pick up the puck and there's like nobody around me. So I look up and Jamie McCowan's standing right in the slot. Nobody's around him. I pass him the puck. Beezer's in net, opens up his 5-hole, and Cooner shoots the puck in the net. Yeah. And we get our
That's
goal. It.
That's exactly right. I remember that on the bench. I remember that.
It was.
That's hilarious.
I couldn't believe that I was actually playing in the game that happened.
That was awesome. What a great story. What a great story to finish on.
Because you remember, the Czechs and the Russians played to a 0-0 tie so that Canada wouldn't win a medal at one of the World Championships.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so Eagle was very aware of that.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
He was like, yeah.
It
was,
hey, we might be foes as nations, but not that night.
No. Yeah. That's awesome. We were North America.
Yeah, we were a North American team. North
Just like
America.
We are now. The That's Patriots. Right,
Magger all the way, buddy. Well, listen, Magger, Theo, I love you. All the best to you and your family. And
you too.
Thanks for joining us right here on Snipes and Stripes on nofilter.net. It's been an amazing, I tell you what, this probably would have been the best show we've ever had.
I know.
Thanks to Theo.
I agree.
All right, guys. Have a good one, guys. Thanks for our sponsors, Whiskey in the Wild, Protected Net Guards, and Bet Online. Best ever. Just like my boy Theo. Go, baby. Keep spreading the word.
You got it. Love Cheers, you boys.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.